It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's Cuban Miami with the Good Time Guys. Raul, George, and Glenn call themselves the three guys from Miami. They bring us the not-to-be-missed specialties and airport food worth the trip. Their book is Three Guys from Miami Cook Cuban. While the Stearns are in a time warp, a 40s small-town cafe with triple-decker cheeseburgers, the Langford Grocery near Houston, cheese guy Steve Jenkins has a truly inspired raft of new takes on what to eat with your cheese. Travel and Leisure magazine's Anya von Brims and says, look to the Midwest for the most exciting restaurants in the country. Then wine critic Matt Kramer talks the new California grape and the latest region to watch. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Today we have something of an American theme going. We get inside Cuban Miami with a trio of self-appointed ambassadors. They call themselves the Three Guys from Miami. Their book is Three Guys from Miami Cook Cuban. That highly opinionated cheesemonger Steve Jenkins plays iconoclast with what to pair with your fromage. Travel and Leisure magazine's Anya von Bremsen has a tour of the most ambitious restaurants in the country and a surprise pick for the city she thinks is cutting the edge. Then the Wine Spectator's Matt Kramer talks California's newest grape and one of the newest places to find it. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, if you want a really great cheeseburger in Houston, Texas, we've got the place for you to go. It's the Langford Cafe and Ice House, and it opened back in the 1940s as a grocery store. Back about 30 years ago, the Langford family decided to start serving food there. Now, there are no more groceries, but there are some of the most delicious hamburgers, cheeseburgers, double hamburgers, and triple bacon cheeseburgers you will ever find anywhere.
A triple bacon cheeseburger, is that triple on the bacon or triple on the burger?
Triple burgers, triple cheese, and approximately double the normal amount of bacon.
Michael got one of these and sat in front of it and really was trying logistically to figure out, or maybe I should say architectonically, to figure out how to get it in his mouth because
it
is huge. I don't think there's anybody who can eat this thing as it is served.
Well, this is a really kind of small town cafe, and when it was brought to my table, everybody else in the place at counter tables and booths was watching because they knew that these things are impossible to eat in a normal way. And I was getting advice from virtually everybody in the cafe about how to do it. And the basic advice is you've got to use fingers, knife, fork, whatever it is, and kind of tear at it. It cannot be picked up and eaten like a regular hamburger.
Now is the secret to their success the quantity, or, I mean, are they doing anything that's unusual with the burger?
I think it's the quality of it. When you order one of these triple Who's a Spectaculars, I think it took half an hour for them to make it. I mean, everything is ground fresh, cooked fresh, and the place itself, the Langford Cafe, is, you know, out of a Stern dream. It is so old fashioned and so adorable, but yet kind of unvarnished and unself-conscious. So we were just, you know, happy to sit there for a half hour waiting for our burger to cook.
But in fact, the quality of the hamburger itself, even if you get a single hamburger, it's really good. I mean, each one is hand-pattied to order, and it's cooked over on a pretty hot grill so that the outside gets real crusty and the inside is still nice and juicy. And also, one of the things that we don't normally think of when we eat hamburgers, but Jimmy Langford, who is kind of the old guy who's been there since he grew up in the place, actually, he told us that one of the secrets of a great burger is, in fact, a really fresh bun. And there's not that there's anything special about these buns. It is not gourmet bread, but they're nice and soft and fresh, and they absorb a lot of those burger juices.
I was so awed by the booth that we were in that it took me a while to focus on the food, because the Langford Cafe has apparently not had any reupholstery done since
ever.
The 1930s. And it was the lumpiest upholstered booth I have ever sat on. It felt like it was stuffed with old Houston phone books.
Its lumpiness matched only by the unevenness of the wood floors in this place. I mean, it's almost like walking up and down stairs to get from your booth to the place where you yourself refill your coffee mug, because that's the way it's done here. It's that casual a kind of place.
And I was really actually quite annoyed because they, you know, if you don't have your own personalized mug there, they give you one, and the waiter brought me over one that said, after 50, gravity takes over. I was not amused.
Guys, what's Houston like these days?
In general, I don't know, but I can tell you that
What a sweeping statement.
Well, I don't know what Houston's
like. But I'll tell
you
anyway.
Except I can tell you, if you want great hamburgers, it is the city to go to. At Lankford Cafe, at fancy restaurants, at mid-level restaurants, burgers are really high on the radar screen in Houston.
You know, Houston gets a bad rap because it's very humid. I think they have a bad crime rate. The traffic is terrible. But when you really get out to the funky spots like the Lankford Cafe, you forget all about the inner city. And it is really like going back into the 1930s. It's wonderful.
Well, I can imagine that the tourist board in Houston is going to be delighted to hear all that. And, hey, guys, thank you.
Okay, Lynn, bye.
I've been everywhere. Yes, a man can go. Between Alaska and Mexico, taking dirt roads and highways through cities and towns. Leave it to Texas to slow you down, 'cause I'm getting used to Houston. No place I'd rather be than deep in the heart with you in my arms. I'm getting used to Houston.
Jane and Michael Stern have made the food world jealous with their now classic Road Food. Everybody wishes they had thought of it first. Now, you can get to hear them first every week on The Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. New York cheesemonger Steve Jenkins is one of the pioneers. About 30 years ago, when any imported cheese was exotic enough to sell, no matter how it was made, Stephen was doing some importers one better. He went after the handmade cheeses, and he did it firsthand. He trekked through Europe and America hunting down the masters. Steve is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. Steve, good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn. Great to be with you as usual.
You know, I've got a purity question for you today.
Purity?
Well, yeah. I mean, the big fashion now is to team cheeses with accompaniments. But then there is this element of, for instance, if I've got a great brie, aren't I going to mess it up if I serve it with fig jam?
You're not going to mess it up, but there's in fact, fig jam is a lovely thing to serve with lots of different cheeses. I think that's very cool. I'm more concerned that people understand that what you serve cheeses with is every bit as important as the cheese itself.
Okay, give me some examples.
Well, brie. You just said brie.
Right.
What I suggest you do is something that's revolutionary and serve that great, incredibly complex, raw, barely pasteurized milk brie with dill pickles. With chutney.
No, wait a minute. Hold it. We've talked about accompaniments before, but this is the first time a dill pickle has come. Those words have not crossed over your lips, sweetie. That dill pickle with brie?
Yeah. It's absolutely delicious. Absolutely delicious.
You tell me and I'll try it. But boy, that is wild.
Well, let me give you a couple other ideas.
All right. Okay.
How about forget the dill pickles? But serve that great brie or that great camembert, the one we like to serve the best. It's called Le Chatelaine, and it's available all across the country.
Uh-huh.
Serve that great brie or that camembert with thin slices of sweet onion, like a Maui sweet or a Vidalia or one of those Texas onions that's
right,
sweet.
Right.
But if you'll take those slices of onion and dust them with either sweet or hot paprika or maybe both.
Uh-huh.
That is a great thing to serve with soft ripened cheeses like real brie or camembert. Because you see, they're so complex that you need something almost challenging to that brie.
Now that does make sense, but let's try, how about blue cheeses?
With blue cheese, I have a marvelous favorite thing that I do. When I serve Roquefort or any of the blues that I love, like Cabrales from Spain, Pecan, mm-hmm. which is almost identical to it, you know, great sweet Gorgonzola or Stilton or whatever blue, I serve it with banana, I serve it with kiwi fruit, and with celery all at the same time. Now, you'd never dream of seeing banana and kiwi fruit and celery on the table in anywhere near each other. But listen to me. Any great blue cheese that thrills you, if you'll just have a little crock of sweet butter and that great blue cheese and some great shards of some crusty bread and then banana and kiwi fruit and celery, you're going to have a cheese experience that whoever you're sharing it with is not going to forget very soon.
Well, you know, as much as you're saying it's an unusual combination, I can understand that dense sweetness of the banana played against the blue, the acidic quality of the kiwi. And heck, I mean, all you have to do is order buffalo wings and you know how great blue cheese is with celery, right?
I mean, so, it's always sounded bizarre, but the marriage is bliss. And also, the other night we served big old hunk of sweet gorgonzola because we'd been working on this thing where we were blending gorgonzola with mashed potatoes and garlic and olive oil and some bacon fat and whipping it up together with a big wooden spatula and serving it really steaming hot. If you take sweet gorgonzola as a cheese course cheese and serve it with slices of roasted potato that you've drizzled with some real complex early harvest olive oil, you're going to have a great cheese experience.
Okay, now what about the American favorite, cheddar? I mean, that's a natural marriage with a lot of stuff.
Well, I'm going to go back to dill pickles, for goodness sake. if you'll pick up some of that great Grafton, Vermont raw milk cheddar that's about 4 years old and readily available any place, and serve that cheddar with dill pickles and chutney, any damn chutney you want to get your hands on, you're going to have a great cheese experience. I got to tell you also.
Yeah.
Mountain cheeses, my beloved mountain cheeses, most of which are cow's milk, you know, like Beaufort from the Savoie or Conte from just north of Savoie in the French Conte, or Italian Fontina d'Aosta, the only Fontina, or Asiago from the Veneto. These are all raw milk cow's milk cheeses that are long aged, all readily available in the United States. I want you to consider this. Your best friends, the person you love the most in the world. Some tomato wedges, if you can find a decent tomato, some quince paste, some grapefruit sections, and some fresh peas in their pods. Serve them with those great mountain cheeses. You won't forget it for a long time.
All right, Steve. Well, on that note, we are going to leave you. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. Now, Steve hangs out behind the cheese counters in New York's Fairway Markets, but you can find his cheese picks on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, sign up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to eat well on weeknights. Every week, we email you a new quick supper recipe, and we send along shopping and technique tips. But best of all, it's free. Now, you can register for it online. You know where. SplendidTable.org. Coming up, three guys from Miami give us a Cuban culture primer and the restaurant town that's cutting the edge. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our program is brought to you by SuperTarget, home of Archer Farms, where you can find modern takes on old-time classics like angel food cake, quiche, and garlic bread. Find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. I came across across this website a while ago, iCuban.com. It's all about Cuban Miami. It's done by a trio who call themselves Three Guys from Miami. Now, you can tell from the tone of the site that they love to have a good time. Well, now they've got a book out, Three Guys from Miami Cook Cuban. Well, the three guys are with me now. We have Raul Musabai, George Castillo, and Glenn Lindgren. Guys, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having
us.
Well, I should, you know, we should explain, Glenn, that we have a Musabai, we have a Castillo, and then we have a Lindgren. I mean, was your mother Cuban or?
No. But I do believe in my last lifetime I might have been Cuban because I very quickly adapted to this new culture.
What was it like for you, Raul and George, to introduce this Scandinavian to Miami and to the Cuban life in Miami?
Okay, you can see he loved the Cuban food. It's not Italian food, but it's very, very delicious.
He means you can see by looking at me. I think that's the implication.
I'm not going there.
It was a lot simpler than you would expect. When this is George, and when I met Glenn, I looked at his girth and I thought, well, he has a happiness curve just like I do. And we called that the happiness curve for all the many times that we have enjoyed eating.
Well, George, if I were to experience a Cuban restaurant, can you pick one that you would want me to go to?
Well, sure. There's one that I really keep coming back, and that is Ay Mama Ines. And that's the name of a country nursery rhyme that all little Cuban kids get to hear. And that place is unique in the sense that it's very much a country kitchen for Cuban. And the menu is very eclectic.
Uh-huh.
And the presentation is very good. And the place is little, but it has a gallery of paintings from Cuban artists that they rotate monthly, and it's very, very attractive. And of course, the food, it tastes very good, and the service is great.
Now for me, the rookie, I know very little about Cuban culture. Tell me maybe three things that I should not miss when I go there to eat.
Okay, that's the trilogy. Rice, black beans, plantains, and roast pork.
And very important, the Cuban sandwich.
Oh, absolutely. That's
staple. Make the difference, believe me.
The Cuban sandwich is almost an art form, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. It is. This is Raul. In order to do a Cuban sandwich, there is two things you have to have in the sandwich. The Cuban bread and the real roast pork, the pernil or back leg.
Uh-huh.
And there is a place or several places, the Latin American cafeteria. They are very, very good.
Is a Cuban sandwich, Glenn, something that I would get at what you call a walk-up window? That seems to be a Miami phenomenon.
Yes, you can. Mostly it's for getting Cafe Cubano, which is the Cuban coffee. But people do, depending on the time of day. If you go there in the morning, people are eating Cuban pastries and drinking mm-hmm. their coffee. If it's around noon, many people will have a Cuban sandwich or any of a number of the little, they call them bocaditos, which are little bites of things that are like a little croqueta or a tamal or something like that.
What makes a great Cuban coffee?
Well, a Cuban coffee is kind of an interesting thing for me because I grew up not liking coffee and I never drank it. And I got to Miami and I kept telling people, no, I don't really like coffee when they would offer it. But I discovered after a while that it's such a ritual there that to not accept a coffee is almost like if someone were to offer to shake your hand and you for some reason refuse. So I started drinking it that way, and it's a powerful cup of coffee. You only drink about 2 ounces, and it's actually brewed right into a pot of sugar. So you can see where that's going to lead
this
you.
This is coffee after my own heart. You know, for a lot of us, the only taste we get of Cuba or Cuban Miami is passing through the Miami airport. Is there any place there you guys would recommend that we could get a taste?
Oh, I am. I am a regular at the airport. I travel a lot, more than I care to due to my work. And when I enter the airport, if there is a delay, I usually visit La Carreta. You can get a tamal or a papa rellena, which is a ball made out of mashed potato with a center full of hamburger meat and seasoned to the Cuban style.
Sounds
and
delicious.
Then it's coated.
Great.
Oh yeah, it's coated cracker crumbles and fried. And it is just a meal in itself. And croquetas are this finger food that are about 3 inches long and about half inch in diameter. That is a dough that is seasoned with Cuban spices and either chicken or ham or cheese added to it. And then they're fried and fried everything.
I have no problem. This sounds so good.
But that's only, like you said, that's just a micro sample of this huge cosmos that we have here in South Florida for food, entertainment, and culture.
Okay, so I'm not selling myself short by eating in the Miami airport. I feel better. Hey, Glenn, George, Raul, thank you.
Thanks so much for
having
us. Thank
you, Lynn.
Thank you, Lynn.
Raul Musabai, George Castillo, and Glenn Lindgren are authors of Three Guys from Miami Cook Cuban. Now, you can find their recipe for Cuban-style roast pork on the website, splendidtable.org. Anya von Bremsen is a concert pianist turned food writer. In fact, an award-winning food writer. She covers the world's food scenes for Travel and Leisure magazine, and her latest book is The Greatest Dishes Around the World in 80 Recipes. Anya, welcome.
Great to be here.
Anya, this piece you did for Travel and Leisure on new American food in 10 cities across America. So what did you see? I mean, what are the trends? What's happening now?
It's been actually very surprising. The one trend that I'm happy with is the gradual waning of the comfort food thing. I think chefs in general have gotten a lot more ambitious, so we're seeing a lot of interesting things. The one trend that I'm really happy to see and that surprised me is ambitious food that uses science. You know, I'm seeing a lot of what's going on in Spain and in Italy and in France sort of slowly trickling in here. For instance, Daniel Patterson in Frisson Restaurant in San Francisco is working with aromas. He's working with perfumes. There's a chef in Chicago, Omar Marocanto at Motto, who is collaborating with NASA scientists to reinvent the language of food. There is a chef, Shea Galante, at Crew in New York, who is doing very much this kind of Spanish-style cuisine that uses a lot of science, a lot of ambition, but translates it into sort of accessible cuisine. Another trend, well, I wouldn't call it a trend, it's more of a movement by now, is this kind of post Alice Waters ingredient worshipping chefs that are promoting the local, the regional, the specific. We're seeing a lot of new, small, intimate market-driven restaurants. For instance, Tafia in Houston with Chef Monica Pope, who is like the Alice Waters Republic ambassador in Houston. You know, she's really encouraged the local farmers market. She, in fact, created it. And every ingredient is mentioned with its provenance, you know, the carrot from this farmer, the chicory from other farmer. We're seeing a lot of that. I would say this is the most prevalent trend.
Is most of this all happening on the coast? What's happening in the middle of the country?
Well, for me, the greatest surprise and the most exciting city right now in the States is Chicago, believe it or not.
Huh.
And Chicago is really in the midst of this kind of Spanish-style culinary revolution. There is this restaurant, Motto, that I mentioned, you know, the chef has 30-some patents. It's hyper-experimental. There is Alinea that's about to be opened or is opened by Grant Achatz, who is like the Ferran Adria of American chefs. And it's going to be this just hyper-experimental tasting menus. There's a great restaurant called the Green Zebra, and they do this fascinating stuff with vegetarian cuisine. You think vegetarian cuisine, oh, you know, how boring, how 60s. But they're doing this super ambitious stuff with it, all this foams and savory ice creams, and it's just like the haute couture, you know, the high design vegetarian cuisine. So there's a real energy there that I think might be paving the way for what's to come in the rest of the states.
You know, there's a lot of logic to this. You know, I'm thinking when you mentioned Ferran Adrià from Spain, it's the man who most famous for his foam, but really kind of deconstructing how food tastes and how food works. And when you think about all the technology in our lives, it's so logical that eventually it would enter into the world of food.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's no excuse for going to a restaurant and having overcooked meat or fish, because there's so many high-tech thermometers available there. And people, you know, it's no longer empirical. For instance, another trend that I'm seeing is cooking sous vide, which means vacuum-packed. And it was popular in the 70s, and now it made a big comeback, because when you take out the air molecules out of food and you cook it at really low temperature, you get all these amazing textures that you don't even expect food to taste like that. And I think it makes perfect sense for cooking to be scientifically driven. And this is going to be a huge thing for the world in the future. It's happening all over the world.
It's going to be interesting to see what a kitchen looks like in 20 years in a restaurant. Hey, Anya, thank you.
It's been great.
Anya von Bremsen writes about the world's food scenes for Travel and Leisure and other publications. Her story on the best new American restaurants is from the December 2004 issue of Travel and Leisure. Evidently, California wine is going through a major shift. Now, according to our guest, it's entering a new age of nuance. Our guest is wine critic Matt Kramer. His column appears in the Wine Spectator, and he's author of Matt Kramer's New California Wine, Making Sense of Napa Valley, Sonoma, the Central Coast, and Beyond. Matt, welcome.
I'm delighted to be here, Lynn.
So, Matt, what are you tracking? I mean, what's most exciting for you right now?
Well, the most exciting thing in California right now is actually not Napa or Sonoma, which everyone has heard of, but really what's called the Central Coast and the South Central Coast. That would be places like Paso Robles and, of course, something like Santa Barbara County, which now everyone knows all about because of the movie Sideways.
So what's happening in those two places, though, that you find so interesting?
Well, in really one word, Syrah. The great change in California in the last 10 years actually started with something called phylloxera. And phylloxera is a root louse. It's a sap-sucking root louse. And what it does is it literally sucks the life out of the vine from the roots, and there is no known cure. So the only thing you can do is uproot the vines and graft them onto rootstocks that are resistant to this louse. And California had it happen to them again. The louse mutated. It happened in the 1880s, and it started again in the 1980s. And what happened was that there was a wholesale replanting in nearly all of the great vineyard areas of California. And what that allowed them to do, at a cost of about $1 billion, was to reconsider what they wanted to grow and where they wanted to grow it. And one of the things they reconsidered was Syrah. And that occurred mostly in Central Coast and South Central Coast.
Now, isn't Syrah one of the grapes that's usually grown in the Rhone Valley? Am I remembering this correctly?
Yeah, it's the signature grape.
Yeah.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. It's the signature grape of wines with wonderful names like Côte Rôti and Hermitage and Côte du Rhône and things like that. And it's also in Australia called Shiraz.
All right, so now let's start with Paso Robles. Some of the vineyards we could look at to track this change in California wine and Syrah?
Well, there's quite a few vineyards in Paso Robles. But before we get to the vineyards, there's one thing about Paso Robles that's worth noting. Paso Robles, by the way, is the nearest city to the Hearst Castle, San Simeon, which a lot of people have visited. And that's right on the coast.
Right.
And if you went inland from San Simeon, you would be in this wine area, which is... there are two parts to it. One is quite hilly and mountainous. That's where San Simeon is, basically. And then when you cross what's really a major divider, Highway 101, it becomes very flat. And they are two different zones, and they're both entitled to the designation Paso Robles. The hilly area has probably the greatest concentration of white chalk soil, probably anywhere in the United States, certainly anywhere in California. And wine growers, vineyard owners love that kind of soil because it gives a very particular kind of stony, minerally taste to the wine. And so a lot of the small wineries in Paso Robles are located on this soil in this very hilly area. So, for example, you would have places like Carmody McKnight is quite fine. And right next door to Carmody McKnight is Justin Vineyards, which is quite famous. And there would be many others, Peachy Canyon Winery, which makes wonderful Zinfandels, as well as Syrah, by the way. Tobless Creek Vineyard, which actually was created by one of the most famous wine growers in France's Rhone Valley, along with their importer. They so loved the soil and the climate that they said, we're coming to Paso Robles to grow what we think are great Rhone variety type wines, which would be Syrah and Grenache. Then on the other side of Highway 101, frankly, it's a little more commercial and a little more industrial. There's a lot of big operations there, like Meridian Vineyards. But the real deal on that side is something we can all find anywhere, which is J. Lohr, L-O-H-R. Well, J. Lohr is a very interesting man. Jerry Lohr owns about 3,000 acres of vines. He controls really all of his production, which a lot of big wineries don't. And he makes wonderful Cabernet. You've probably seen a brand called Seven Oaks. And that comes from Paso Robles. And he also makes beautiful Syrah. And really, it's an amazing deal for the money. Typically, a J. Lohr wine might cost you $12 to $15 a bottle. And actually, I was very impressed when I went to visit, which I normally am not with very big wineries.
Right, right. Hey, Matt, it's so interesting, just on either side of a road, such differences. Scott, so much to know about. Matt, thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much, Lynn.
Matt Kramer's wine column appears in the Wine Spectator. He's author of Matt Kramer's New California Wine, Making Sense of Napa Valley, Sonoma, the Central Coast, and Beyond. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what relationship does a banana have to a kimono? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what relationship does a banana have to a kimono? Well, as it turns out, you can make a kimono from a banana tree. And the kimonos made from that tree are often national treasures. Kimonos in Japan are like cheeses in France. Each area of the country has its own kinds, and within each area, there are giveaways as to who the kimono was made for, like for royalty or for the lower classes. Bashofu was the fabric of Okinawa, starting way back in the 1300s. Now, it comes from a very small part of Okinawa. The way it's done is that the pulp inside the local banana tree is boiled, scraped, split, spun, dyed, and woven all by hand. And it's still done that way today. And the Bashofu fabric is protected as a local treasure. Now, one look at which Bashofu print someone was wearing, and you could tell their status. The royalty and the rich had large geometric patterns in violet or red and yellow. Then, as you slid down the social scale, your kimono pattern got smaller and its colors grew paler until your kimono was the color of a washed-out banana.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, so warm and tender, call me.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get to the phones. We have got Betsy from Knoxville, Tennessee on the line. Hey, Betsy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. My sister and I love to go to Shakertown, which is at Pleasant Hill in Kentucky.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
And they have a vegetable there called salsify. And we have looked everywhere. I travel a lot in my business, and I have looked for salsify on grocery shelves, at markets, Chicago, all kinds of places.
Uh-huh.
I can't find it anywhere. I know it's an old-fashioned vegetable, but it's wonderful.
Well, I have to tell you, first of all, I'm very jealous of you going to Pleasant Hill. And is the food wonderful yet? Because I was there years and years ago. For people who don't know what we're talking about, this is the only Shaker restoration that you can spend the night. There's an inn. This is a Shaker community in Kentucky, not terribly far from Louisville. And it's like, it really is entering another world. But I remember the food was wonderful.
Well, and I highly recommend it to anybody because you're right. It's a beautiful place to stay.
Oh, it's fabulous. Okay, salsify. Also known, by the way, as oyster plant.
Yes, I found that out.
Yeah. And you're right, it is an old-fashioned vegetable, and it's a more of a winter vegetable. It looks like a carrot that decided to be very tall. If a carrot wanted to be a basketball player, and it's black on the outside and white on the inside.
Right.
And it may run as long as 2 feet long. And it has, it's called oyster plant because it has this very lovely, subtle, but fulsome flavor. Now, I'm trying to think, where would you find it? It's hard to find almost anywhere. Are you willing to think about mail order? I mean, it's going to get pricey.
Oh, no, I would be happy to do that. Oh. I'll tell you the truth. I went online, and I even bought seeds.
Yeah.
And I tried growing it.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't successful at that.
Yeah.
And I'm an antique dealer, and I have found packages of the seed from back at the turn of the 20th century. But
I wonder if they'd sprout. Boy, wouldn't that be so
cool? I haven't been successful growing it.
Well, okay. Well, it needs very loamy soil, and it is grown more in cooler climates. This is what I'm thinking. Two places that have always specialized in unusual stuff is Frida's, and I think it's just Frida's.com. I think it's IEDS.
Okay.
.com. And Melissa's, MELISSA. Now, these are two companies that supply a lot of the specialty stuff that you see in the supermarkets.
Okay.
Now, I know Frida's has prided itself on introducing America to stuff that, you know, nobody's ever heard of.
Right.
I would go on their website and see if you see anything about salsify.
Okay.
All right. And then the other thing is go to Melissa's website and see, because you may be able to mail order it.
Okay.
Now, the other things I would do, there's two other things that may work. There's a store in New York City called Citarella, C-I-T-T-A-R-E-L-L-A, something like that.
Uh-huh.
And I think they've got a couple of stores in New York, and boy, they might carry it.
Okay.
They carry fabulous stuff. And the other thing I check out is something like Whole Foods or Fresh Fields.
Okay.
Check their websites.
Oh, I appreciate it so much.
Hey, you are welcome.
I'll let you know what happens.
Please do. And you're making me remember my days at the Shaker Restoration. It was just wonderful.
Oh, it is. It's really all of the food is wonderful, but the salsify is something we just can't find any place other than there. So.
Yeah, well, it's not easy.
Hey, no, I appreciate it.
Thanks for calling, Betsy.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252.
Did you know that the Shakers, now this is this group that was in its heyday in the 19th century, the Shakers were the first people to actually package seeds for commercial sale, and they were the first people to do widespread commercial canning. They were famous for their food. They were farmers, they were architects, and they were a sect that did not marry. And they took in orphans, they took in people who, you know, had nowhere to go, and they thrived up until around the end of the Civil War. There were a few Shakers left as of about 20 or 30 years ago, but there are Shaker restorations all over the Northeast and in Ohio and Kentucky. Fabulous places to visit. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's talk with Allison. She's calling from Louisville. Hey, Allison, what's up?
Well, what's up is that my grandfather used to grow these tomatoes. I would eat them every day with a little salt, and I cannot find what type of tomatoes they are until I walked into an organic store and got an heirloom tomato.
Uh-huh.
And I want to know where I can get a hold of the seeds so I can grow.
Oh, now you're in Louisville, Kentucky?
Right.
I just wonder if local seed stores aren't carrying them, because I walked through one of your farmers markets about 3 years ago in August, and it looked like you guys had cornered the market on every heirloom tomato. I mean, everybody had them. You might find them in like local food co-ops or health food stores or specialty stores, you know, the fancy food stores. You can go online. A couple of places. One, there's a place online called Johnny's Seeds.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, you know, one of my favorite places is Seed Savers. Seed Savers is this incredible place in Iowa where they're trying to keep viable all kinds of old varieties of food plants. You know, they keep growing them so they have more seeds. And people send them seeds, and they have a catalog that will blow your mind. It's like reading a telephone book. And as I remember, what's fun about it is it'll say, well, now this comes from Mrs. Jones, and she lives in blah, 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 Florida. She says that in her garden, it's wonderful. So Seed Savers, Decorah, Iowa, and I know they have a website. And they're all about biodiversity. And if you buy from them, you're supporting a great cause for the planet. You know, it's a political act. Another place is the Cook's Garden. We've had them on the show, and they do organic seeds, and they'll have a ton of heirlooms. Once you get into heirloom tomatoes, you're entering a world. We're going to lose you for years. You're going to have more fun trying these babies out. So that should get you rolling.
Oh, I can't wait.
By the way, one of the favorites that everybody loves, and it should do pretty well in your area, is called the Brandywine. It's sort of the love child of all heirloom tomatoes, and it may remind you of that tomato that your grandfather grew.
Oh, that taste.
I know.
I can still relive that taste.
You are it, Allison. You are in for one gorgeous summer. I can't tell you.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, I can't wait.
Oh, you're going to have a blast. Hey, thanks for a great question.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Are we a little over the top here? Sure. But heirloom tomatoes? Ugh, fabulous. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see now. We've got Heidi on the line from Virginia Beach. Hey, Heidi, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I'm trying to find out if there's an easy way to peel an acorn squash.
Oh, boy. Yeah, they have ridges. It's so much fun. What shape do you want the final pieces to be in, like in cubes or, you know?
Yeah, I've been peeling them for stews and things.
Okay.
And so they get diced.
Because one of the things you could do is you cut it in wedges, lay the wedge on its side, and don't even try to peel, you know, the skin along those ridges. Just make an arc cut where you eliminate the whole ridge thing. And then you'll just get this big, like, quarter moon of squash. And then you can dice it or do whatever you need to with it. And that way, you know, cut it like a pie, essentially.
Yeah.
And then flip that pie slice on its side and then just, you know, with the knife. And you're there.
And that's what I was doing. And I just thought, there's got to be an easy way.
Oh, unfortunately, there isn't. Because it's such, first of all, it's a hard squash.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, you just got those bumps. But you know what's easier and it's sweeter and it's tastier. Do you know about kombucha?
No, I don't.
Well, they're I'm not sure if they're down in Virginia Beach, but I know they're popping up in supermarkets all over the place. They look like a small green squat pumpkin. And they're one of these really sweet squashes that are appearing now. And they're fairly, I'd say they're probably about 8 inches across. And they're real easy to peel because, again, if you cut them like a wedge, they're just a little softer and they tend to just cut more easily.
Huh.
The other thing, look also for sweet dumpling. Another squash that, by the way, you bake it in its skin. You know, you just cut it in half. It's a littler squash. Mm-hmm. And then you can bake it like halfway and then stuff it with rice and beans and spice and finish it off. And you can eat the cup you've cooked the stuff in. Mm-hmm. And they're just delicious. But the kombucha is really sweet and it cooks up creamy almost. Hmm. I mean, I guess what I want to say is it's kind of sexier than an acorn. but I know what you mean because I'm a great butternut fan and I go through the same thing. Peeling the blessed thing is just a pain. You know, yeah. The other thing you could do is parboil it with the skin and then just take it out and pull the skin.
Yeah, this
off.
Is for a stew. So if I pre-cooked it, it would be a mush.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing too is you could roast it. I mean, that makes it soft, but you could roast it sort of halfway, and then you can just pull the skin off very easily. Mm-hmm. And that'll give it a brown taste. You know, that's not a bad idea. Rub it with olive oil. Rub the wedges with olive oil or chunks with olive oil mm-hmm. and roast it at 450 on a piece of foil that you've oiled so that, you know, it's not going to stick. Mm-hmm. And then you get a roasted squash taste, and you get it, just cook it halfway, and then you can get the skin off much more easily. And if you throw that in the stew, it'll add another dimension of flavor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, wouldn't that be neat?
That would be great.
Okay.
Well,
all
thank
right.
Thank you so much.
Hey, you are welcome. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. These winter squashes, you know, part of the deal is they can last forever once they're cut, you know, because that heavy skin protects them. Keep them cold, keep them away from moisture, and they're fine. But that skin's also kind of like trying to break through armor. Call us, 800-537-5252. I have got a Santa Fe report. I'm just back and talk about the best time to go there right now in the winter because there are almost no tourists. The hotels are pretty cheap. There's lots of gallery shows and films and bargain eating. Now, I'm always looking for New Mexico food, which is usually really simple. And my latest find is a place called La Choza, C-H-O-Z-A. It's inexpensive and it's really good. The two things you have to have is their pozole, which is this stew of hominy and chili and bits of pork. It's just delicious. Ask for a big bowl of it. And the other thing you have to order is the pork adobado. This is pork cooked in red chili. But the most important thing, Saturday morning, the farmer's market. There's not a lot of people there, but you're going to find garlic and chili from the last harvest, which would be the fall. And there's a market guy there. He's a farmer named David. He grows garlic. And one of the things he's done is he's taken the green shoots of the garlic, you know, that spring up. He has dehydrated them and powdered them. And he sells them in little bags, and they're not garlic powder. They taste green and fresh and lively. His name's Dave. It's green garlic, and it's fabulous. So Santa Fe in the winter, bargains to be had, great fun, and the weather is gorgeous. Well, the Oscars are over, and the McDonald's movie Super Size Me didn't make it, but there was another burger movie that was completely overlooked, and this one was a celebration of the burger. Filmmaker George Motz has produced Hamburger America. He's on the phone from Brooklyn, New York. George, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, George, with all this bad press, why in heaven's name the hamburger?
Oh, I'm a huge fan of the hamburger. Simply put, I mean, I someone needed to stand up for the burger, and I figured I had to be that guy.
So how did you do this in Hamburger America? What's the film about?
Well, the film is about 8 different restaurants across the country that basically do burgers really well. Not well done, but they basically do a really good job making burgers.
Uh-huh.
And one of the criteria for being in the film is you had to have a burger on your menu for over 40 years.
40 years?
Over 40 years you had to have a burger on the menu in order to be in the film. So that basically eliminated thousands of places right off the bat. So what if for a place to stick around for 40 years, it has to go through at least 2 or 3 generations of family?
What we found
was the places that could stick around for more than 40 years were the ones we wanted to have in the film.
Uh-huh. And they're all family-owned?
Yeah, pretty much. Seven of the eight were still family-owned. Same family, same 70, 80 years in some cases. In one case, it was 107 years, one of the restaurants in New Haven.
So tell me, I mean, tell me some of the highlights. What were some of the great finds?
One of the stores we loved a lot was a guy in Oklahoma, in Mears, Oklahoma, who raises Texas Longhorn just for the burgers in his restaurant. The cows are obviously, they're raised on grass. They're grass-fed.
Right, right.
So you basically have a cattle that has what he calls yellow fat, which doesn't cause cholesterol, he says in the film.
What's the name of the place, and where exactly is it?
It's called the Mears Store in Mears, Oklahoma. And it's about an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes south of Oklahoma City, in what he calls the middle of nowhere.
I remember some mention in something I read about a peanut burger.
No, peanut butter burger, yeah. There's a burger in Sedalia, Missouri called the Goober Burger. There's a guy who cranks out about 150 to 200 Goober Burgers a day in the summertime. And basically, it's just a hamburger with peanut butter on it.
Instead of ketchup.
Instead of ketchup. But he actually does put, I didn't order that burger, but he started to make for me a burger that was ketchup, mayo, peanut butter, tomato, and lettuce. And just to me, it was a little bit much. So
the only thing missing is the banana.
Right. But I got to tell you, the peanut butter on the burger is the one that I do make at home all the time. It tastes fantastic.
I'll be darned. Any others that had a particularly interesting story or something?
Yeah, well, actually, one of the main reasons we really got going on this film was the story of Dyer's of Memphis, which is the home of the deep-fried hamburger. And this is basically a burger where they smash it thin as paper, and then they slide it into this huge vat of grease, and it cooks. It's absolutely incredible. In the movie, he basically says when it comes to the top, it's done. It only takes about 3 minutes or two
mm-hmm,
minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But the great story there was that these guys moved. People were afraid that if they moved, they would leave this grease behind. And the story was they've actually had this grease, using the same grease for deep frying burgers for over 94 years now.
Wait a minute. In the same fat?
The same fat. I mean, you know, every day they have to put a little bit more in. And
right.
But the story there was they were moving the restaurant, and they decided to bring the grease with them.
Tanker truck.
No, they actually brought it by police escort with a huge, you know, parade and the press. Good Morning America was there. It was incredible. So we have all this footage of the grease being moved from the old location to the new location.
Only in America.
In America, you're right.
George, thank you.
My pleasure.
George Motz is producer of the documentary film Hamburger America. Well, that's the show for this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this advice on pairing food and beverage from Calvin Trillin. He said that we should serve Coke or RC with meat, 7-Up or Sprite with fish, and Dr. Pepper with game. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.